Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Greg Lambert, and I'm sitting in for Marlene Gebauer this week. On the show, we've been talking over the past couple of months how just the changes in legal tech since the launch of these generative AI tools from companies like OpenAI and others starting late last year, instead of us measuring progress in quarters and years and decades, we're now at this point where we're measuring them in days and weeks instead. And it's just amazing how quickly things are changing. And our guests this week really exemplify that fact. We were going to have Nathan Walter from Briefpoint AI back in February on the show to talk about leveraging AI in his product using products like GPT. So that interview kind of fell through, but quite frankly, I'm kind of glad it did, because the amount of advancement in just that time has just been flat out insane. So it also gave us an opportunity for Nathan to bring in someone else with him to talk about the advancements that have taken place. So we'd like to welcome Nathan Walter, CEO and legal engineer at Briefpoint AI, and Bridget Albiro, design director at Briefpoint. Bridget and Nathan, welcome to The Geek in Review.
Happy to be here.
Thanks so much for having us.
So, Nathan, before we start talking about, again, this rapid change in technology, I did want to point out something that you discussed with Chad Main on his Technically Legal podcast, and I don't mind stealing from Chad, and I think Chad probably steals from me as well. So you guys talked about the fact that you are or were a stand-up comedian. I do first want to point out, you're not our first stand-up comedian that we've had on the show. We had Eugene Cipirone from Goodman's in Toronto was on the show a couple of years ago. But, you know, as I was thinking about how to write a question, I'm just going to ask, so does legal tech inspire comedy, or does comedy inspire legal tech? How does that work?
I mean, there's certainly a comedy of errors. And I think that
that's for sure.
With comedy, you do have to be pretty human and empathetic and sort of understand psychology up to a small degree, either implicitly or expressly. And having that is very helpful when you're trying to sell something that is very not human, that is very procedural. So it's nice to have a more human and less stiff face representing something that is a little bit scary and daunting to a lot of people.
Do you ever do some just some walk-up or some stand-up?
Open mics.
Anymore?
I haven't in a while. The last time I did stand-up, I think it was 2018, I did the Parent Teacher Association of Orange County, California annual comedy event. And it went great. It was a lot of fun.
Man, I don't even know how to react to that, apparently. there's just some comedy in saying that. So
I got pretty dark.
So Nathan, you've had a pretty interesting legal career, you know, and during your practice of law, you know, what are some of the high points and the low points of your practice, and what motivated you to turn more toward the entrepreneurial goals of starting a company like Briefpoint?
Yeah, so I think the high points for me, I guess, from my if we want to do it purely on like a physiological reaction, would be going into court and winning a motion that I was not expected to win, or winning some sort of whatever was the target of the hearing. And just coming out of that, you feel like you're just on fire. You know, you're in the courthouse parking lot, punching your steering wheel going. And those were certainly very high points.
Right.
And actually, the feeling of that was very similar to what happens on comedy. When you have a really good set, you just feel like you have this internal fire. Now, with comedy, I felt that feeling of fire for about three times as long as I did with winning a hearing, because you would end up just going back into the office and sitting on your computer and slowly typing away a discovery response. But
you didn't get a standing ovation from the rest of the lawyers when you walked back in?
I felt like it was deserved.
With your hands raised.
I was like, why is no one clapping? No, of course not. Honestly, some of the times I won, I just felt the judge may have just felt bad for me. Those were the high points. And then more generally, the high points was just being able to help someone who is in this process of litigation who they're very scared. It's very confusing. They don't understand how it works, but they understand the implications of it not working in their favor can result in their livelihoods being seriously impacted, which is really a lack of control. And for them to trust litigators specifically to help them in that, I think is a huge honor. That wasn't it all the time. I mean, there's a lot of things wrong with the practice of litigation. There's a lot of things wrong with access to justice. And the source, I believe, is the billable hour model to a large degree. I think that the billable hour models, it inherently pits you against your client in some way, because are you really incentivized to do what's in their best interest? In my experience, every attorney that I worked with, they were always interested in reducing billable hours. But for their clients. But that was at odds with the internal structures of the firm, who needed to keep the lights on, who to a large degree are manufacturers of billable hours. And I found that conflict to be disheartening. And when you have to lay it out for your client and say, hey, I know you didn't do anything wrong. Like, I actually know the facts of this case. I legitimately know you did not do anything wrong, but they're only suing you for $100,000. Maybe you should just pay them. That killed me. And that's sort of why I started to teach myself code to figure out a way to prevent that from happening.
Yeah. Had you always had that bug, that entrepreneurial bug to start something, or were you just so frustrated with what you were doing? You're like, I got to find a better way to do this.
Frankly, I see entrepreneurship as a necessary evil. I never thought I'd be running a company. I never was a business person. I had to learn very quickly, obviously. But when I looked at what I wanted to do, which was sort of create a world where litigators, number one, wouldn't need to make great sacrifices of their personal lives in order to maintain competency. And number two, be able to take on lower value cases and fight for them for longer, thereby increasing access to justice. We live in a society. We live in a society. We live in a capitalistic society. So creating a business was the most efficient way for me to affect that change and that in the industry. And so that's why I chose to start a business.
Now, with Briefpoint, you have a very simple but a huge idea behind the product, and that is you want to create an innovative solution that automates various aspects of the litigation process that attorneys need to do. And your overall goal seems to be to automate the entirety of the process from demand letter all the way through appeals. You know, just easy stuff,
yeah.
Right?
So. It's so funny. So yeah, specifically document preparation, which at the most conservative comprises about 40% of a litigator's job.
Yeah.
That is what we're trying to automate. And the tongue-in-cheek goal is to remove typing from document preparation. And that's what we're heading towards. And we're hoping to be a force multiplier for firms. We're hoping to incentivize firms to maybe use different billing structures other than the billable hour. And that's much harder said than done. But even then, over 60% of our users are billable hour attorneys, because the work that we automate is frankly just not the work that you want to do. It's kind of rote. It's a little bit boring. And it's not why you went to law school. It doesn't require a high degree of analysis or critical thinking. And by removing that, we just increase the quality of life for our users.
Right now, who are your customers? Are they tend to be solo small firm? They're in California only, or what's your customer base now? And I think what are you looking for?
We target small and solo firms, but that was purely a business decision and not necessarily our overarching intent. We do have medium-sized firms as well, and we're actively discussing with AM Law 100 firms in regards to partnering to actually create a tailored version of BriefPoint for their firm and their practice areas that would they would benefit from because they have a solution that works for them, and then we would benefit from because we get their feedback and access to their documents, which makes automating those documents much easier. To touch on why we target small firms, it boils down to the length of a sales cycle. And when you are talking to larger firms, there's not really, you know, there's a whole network of decision makers, and there's librarians and different partners. And sometimes you'll be talking to what we call a champion at the firm who wants to install BriefPoint. And they'll say something like, you know, I want this, but even though I want this, there's no way I can do this because there's so many barriers. With a small firm, I've closed a deal in 8 minutes. So the sales cycle was 8 minutes long because I'm talking to the owner of the firm and we've priced it such that it's, you know, it works for small firms. And so we needed to, as we approach and as we sort of live in these longer sales cycles with larger firms, we still need revenue in the door. And so we target small and solo firms a lot. And I think that's been helpful because when I proceed into any legal tech company, you're walking through a graveyard of companies that went whale hunting for these large firms and died waiting on the sales cycle to close. And in recognition of that, I wanted to make sure that we were able to get money in the door as soon as possible.
Yeah, I know Marlene and I have been on the other side of that where we're wanting to get something closed, but there's so many processes internally and people who have to sign off for us to, you know, get anything done. So it makes sense, you know, at least for now, I think to focus on where you are.
Yeah.
So Bridget, we're really happy to have you here because we love having UX and design folks come in, especially those who aren't former practicing lawyers, you know, because, you know, I think, you know, folks that come in from outside the industry have this fresh perspective and aren't beaten down by the sales cycle and, you know, this is how we always do it kind of thing and just bring in new perspectives. So, you know, what caused you initially to even want to get into the user design and or user experience and design profession?
Yeah, well, I initially studied fine art and design in undergrad. And then I kind of made my way to do some coursework in industrial design. And I was planning on, you know, maybe going to graduate school for industrial design because the whole, like, how humans interact with physical products and technology has always been fascinating to me. Then when I kind of realized that user experience design is, like, where graphic design and industrial design really meet, it just felt perfect. So, yeah, that's kind of how I ended up here. And I love it. There's always a fun creative problem to solve. It's very gratifying to know that, you know, you have a user that's experienced your product and it's made their life easier or more enjoyable.
Do you get a lot of feedback? Do you seek a lot of feedback from the users so that you understand, or do you have automated ways to look at that? What's your process on this?
Yeah, we are always interested in our user feedback. And Nathan has created, you know, a lot of personal relationships with our early users to kind of create that pipeline for fast and feedback often from our users. But I think it's an advantage for being so small to have like a real connection with our first time users and early adopters. And we take all of that very seriously because we always have to remind ourselves that we are not our users. So we can make our best assumptions and do our own research on the side, but our users are really going to provide like the most valuable feedback.
Yeah. So when I did some programming when I was in law school in the 90s, I had somebody tell me once that making something is really easy, but making something really easy is not. And so, you know, that whole user experience design, you know, just makes it easier for the user to use a product that's really, you know, a product like this is really complex when you break it down, But the trick is, or, you know, the goal is to make it easy. So,
yeah. And I love that. I feel like I thrive in taking like a very complex sort of, maybe not the most exciting product to use, like the challenge of making that intuitive and a little bit fun to use is pretty great. Good.
Now you've been there at Briefpoint a little less than a year, but 2022 and 2023 are not just different numbers. It's almost like a different universe, I think, when it comes to technology like this. So, I ask, what are some of the interesting things that are happening now that you may not have thought you could be doing when you started last year?
I think just like the capability of, you know, our capability using a network of AI networks, it's just really, it surpassed my expectations. And I've been able to see that sort of progress. And I feel like other people can kind of relate, and to just see that technology take off has been really exciting. I'm always excited to see my designs and my workflows implemented because I'm usually at the beginning of the process. And when I am able to see it coded and working, it's so satisfying. But to see what we're able to achieve today is just, it's remarkable. Like I feel like I pinch myself because even in the past week, like, you know, just testing out our product is, I'm like, wow, this is really possible.
That's good. I mean, you want somebody that has pride in their work. So I'm sure oh, Nathan appreciates that. Right, Nathan?
I tell Bridget that she's 99% of the value of our company and not to sue me for that value.
There we go. Well, you've shown me Briefpoint now a couple of times, so I've become familiar with it. But if I'm an attorney in, you know, California or another state where you have the product that can help me, what is it that Briefpoint does? Kind of the lowest hanging fruit. What's the easiest thing for me to look at as a litigator that Briefpoint could help me do?
Oh, yes. So probably worth explaining what we do, right? What Briefpoint does is you log in, you upload your opposing counsel's discovery request PDF, and then our AI takes data from that PDF in order to rapidly construct a response document. So you upload your opposing counsel's discovery request PDF, you select some objections, or you click suggest, and we'll write the objections for you. And then you click open in Word, and then a Word document is downloaded, and that Word document is a completed response to that discovery request.
Super, super simple?
Simple. Yeah, it's super easy, honestly.
Nathan, you know, when we were prepping for our talk back in February, you and I jumped on a call where you were showing me some of the really impressive things that you were doing with Briefpoint then. And at that point, you know, the hot tool was GPT 3.5, which had been out, about a month or two by that point. And you were showing how you were using that to automate the processes. Again, and just that little bit of time between then and now, the release of GPT-4 came out, and there's some other generative AI tools that have launched since. How has that advancement altered the product and the timeline that you had for releasing the advancements that you had planned in Briefpoint?
Yeah, I mean, any company that did not have an emergency meeting regarding GPT-4 the day the technical report was released, I believe is unwittingly barreling towards irrelevancy. The jump between 3.5 and 4 was just monumental. I wouldn't say historic, because I think that historically we'll look at ChatGPT as sort of the start of these things, given its use and its wide adoption. The GPT-4, though, is what we call like a baby artificial general intelligence, or a baby AGI. And for a system to have an apparent internal representation of the world, and to be able to really think critically and pass the bar in the 90th percentile in 7 minutes, we had to redo our whole roadmap. Our initial roadmap, which was aggressive a month ago, or I guess 2 months ago, was far too conservative in light of these new large language models. And it's GPT-4, it's Claude, you know, Hugging Face by Microsoft. These things just launched us way further than I think anyone expected, even the people that created it. So our initial roadmap was, okay, let's just tackle documents one document type at a time. And so we'll start with discovery, and then we'll do forms, and then we'll do complaints, and then answers, and then we'll, I used to say this all the time, then we'll just work our way chronologically from demand letter to appeal, document by document. But given what we've been able to do with these large language models in conjunction with our existing AI systems, we're just going to automate all the documents all at once. And that shortened our roadmap from like a 3-year roadmap to a 9-month roadmap. And that, and I mean, the testing that we've done so far, it is just, given the connections we've been able to make between these large language models and our AI systems, it's creating stuff that's better than, frankly, I would have done. And I'm proud to say I was a mediocre litigation attorney.
Well, I guess you really don't have, I mean, I think it makes sense that you want to have your plan, this linear plan, you know, doing A, then B, then C. And now you can kind of, you know, have this multidimensional aspect of where you're doing many things all at once. So, Bridget, that sounds great for Nathan. How big a headache is that for you to now all of a sudden you've got much more coming at you much, much faster? How are you handling the rapid advancement?
I would much more prefer to work with someone who is very ambitious than the opposite. I think it's exciting. And in my previous work, I started out in a small startup. We were acquired, and then that startup was acquired. And at the end of my run in health tech, I was working for a large corporation. And it's, to me, it's so refreshing to be working with a small team because we are able to be really nimble and we are not bogged down by our 2-year roadmap that has no flexibility and is filled with, you know, client commitments. We are able to be really flexible and respond to new client asks that we maybe didn't think of as features and, you know, market demands. And I see that as a huge advantage. So yeah, I feel like that gives me the opportunity to do a lot more interesting work.
Yeah. And Nathan, with the, just again, the speed of the advancements that's coming out, how do you stay up to date with what's going on in the market? And then, you know, you might be 3/4 of the way through some advancement and then a new tool comes out and you're like, crap, you know, now we could, if we put this on, how do you kind of corral all of the, all of the changes so that you can still make the advancements, but not let it get overwhelming?
Yeah, so I just watch what Daniel Katz does on a daily basis. Now, so, I mean, I've probably read every paper written on GPT-4, and, you know, I keep a very close eye on these things. I feel like I have a pretty good idea of the trajectory given the AI's ability to improve itself, Reflexion, and then connecting of networks with Hugging Face by Microsoft. I'm tracking the trajectory, and it's really about a sort of just following the trajectory, but understanding that you're going to need to pivot. And what that means in practice is making these things modular so that we can swap out pieces of our tech that get made redundant given a new advancement. And that's basically why we structure all these AIs into a specific network where they're all doing specific tasks as opposed to having one that does everything. And it is moving fast. I mean, it is moving incredibly fast. And it's you have to be on the ball. And I think that is another advantage of being a smaller team is that we can adapt quickly. For example, the Florida tort reform passed, and we initially were targeting, we're like, okay, we're going to go from California to Texas to New York to all this stuff. And then the Florida tort reform passed. And now, you know, we have large firms that filed 70,000 cases 2 months ago. And so we're like, oh, okay, so now let's shift over here. Then we look at the Florida documents. We're like, okay, can we do this? And now it's given the capabilities, it looks like we could probably launch to every jurisdiction this summer, hopefully. But it's about just keeping track of it. In practice, you know, you look at the people that write the papers, you connect with them on LinkedIn or follow them, you go to these conferences. I always go to Stanford Codex, and that's Stanford Codex is about three years ahead of the curve in technology. And so talking with those people, being involved with those research projects, I work in conjunction with Dr. Ian Schick from the Machine General Legal Document Research arm of Stanford Codex, and just being on the pulse, having those relationships with those CEOs, sharing different tips and tricks, and really it's really relationships and maintaining those, checking in and seeing what's going on, because the news is not going to do it for you. Google searches aren't going to do it for you. Look at the research papers that were written on GPT-4, get the names of the authors, find them on LinkedIn, and start building a relationship.
Yeah, and I found a lot of those folks that are writing those papers are very open to having these conversations. It's almost like a, I don't know, like a desire for them to have somebody they can talk to and bounce ideas off.
Oh yeah.
Them.
I could talk about that too. You know, I love talking about this, but everyone in my life doesn't. You know, no one in my life loves it as much as I do. And so when I'm with my girlfriend out at dinner and I strike up a conversation about AI, takes her everything not to push her chair back and drive home. So it's really awesome to talk. It's a nerd thing. It's just a nerd thing. Yeah. You know, we're just nerds. Yeah,
I had the same thing. I was at my in-laws' place in Oklahoma over the weekend, and my brother-in-law, who's a teacher, my wife's a teacher. I was just like wanting. It's like, what are you guys doing in the education system? What are you doing? And wanted to have this conversation, and they were like, well, we're just kind of checking it out right now. We're not really doing anything. And I'm like, you're falling behind. And I wanted almost broke into a lecture right there. So I have I understand the excitement, and it's really interesting to see. And I think you're seeing it in law firms as well. I think you're seeing a lot of law firms that are dipping their, some are diving in, but most are dipping their toe in. There's some out there that are like, yeah, we're going to wait to see how this works out, and if it works out fine, then we'll jump in. And I think those firms are never going to catch up.
Yeah, because every day you wait, and every day you wait to adopt a tech used to be a day. Now every day you wait to adopt a tech, it's about a year. So I know firms that are very hesitant, and I understand why. And I think they have justification for that. I totally understand. But the world has changed dramatically, and we are going to see AI is going to hit society like a freight train.
Yeah. It definitely is. So, one, I would say, do you have a lot of competition now with what you're doing? And if not, do you see, I kind of look at like CLMs, just how many companies are in that field now? Do you see a lot of startups like yourself jumping in or do you think this is something that if you're not in there right now, you're going to be behind on?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think for all legal tech, even CLM, the competition is the status quo, and it will always be the status quo. I have a good relationship with one of my competitors that does discovery. Well, among other things, they generate responses to discovery requests. They're sort of in a different lane. They're more sort of on the corporate side of things. And I don't know if they're incorporating these things. We've been planning and for incorporation of these large language models since 2021. So we're a little bit ahead of the ball there, if not very far from ahead of the ball. And the requisite skills you need to actually wield these things are very hard to find in the market, because I'm doing legal engineering with an understanding of how these large language models work. Namely, they're transformers, right? And I probably would bet there's only 15 other people in the United States that have that capability. And I'm encouraged by the fact that they're not working on what I'm working on. Like Daniel Katz, and of course, you have the Case Text and those, and yeah. Jake from that team over
Jake
there.
Jake and Pablo.
Of course.
Pablo had him on a couple of weeks ago, is a
wonderful person to have in our field. I'm always thankful that he didn't get into financial tech, because he's really, what Pablo's doing is incredible, and he's doing it right. And I'm really glad that he's not doing document automation. Not yet.
So, Bridget, how do you involve the Briefpoint's users? We talked about it a little bit when it comes to the design process, but as you're developing new ways of working through the documents, ways of preventing, as Nathan was saying, to eliminate typing from the process, how do you make sure that what sounds like a really cool, great idea for you is actually something on the user side that is actually usable?
Yeah, our users are really good at providing feedback. I think that a lot of our early adopters are people who are very enthusiastic about technology, and they know that our technology is young and they want to be heard. And I think we've shown that we really value that feedback. So it's definitely an ongoing goal and challenge in some way, but we've been pretty fortunate so far to have really great user feedback.
And Nathan, do you get that feedback as well?
Yeah. And really, just to toot Bridget's metaphorical horn, she is just incredible at distilling these advanced processes into very just click, execute workflows where, for example, one of our most prolific users was a paralegal. And before she was a paralegal, she spent 15 years in a monastery in Northern California with no access to the outside world or technology. And she is our most prolific user. She uses it all the time, and she didn't need to be trained in it, because we believe that as long as you know how to draft the document as you already do, then you'll know how to use Briefpoint. And so what I'm able to do, given Bridget's expertise, is say, okay, this is how we do it right now. These are the steps we're going to automate. And we don't change the workflow. We don't change the order of operations. We sort of map our own workflow on the existing attorney workflows, except instead of 20 steps, there's now one. And Bridget is just very meticulous about making things very clear, like what is the attorney doing. For example, she prioritizes use of descriptive buttons over symbols and icons that an attorney would otherwise have to learn, right? And she's been very successful in that. And that's sort of, and I think that's one of our secret sauces. That's why we brought on Bridget. And Bridget she's been working full time for less than a year, but she was with the founding group. So she's been with Briefpoint since the start. At least part-time and now full-time. And I wanted someone like Bridget on the team, because what I saw in the legal tech field before Briefpoint were really good ideas that were displayed to the user in a way that looked like an engineer built it and operated like an engineer built it. And I thought that was one of the reasons that there was such slow adoption of tech, is just because the tech... attorneys don't want to have to take a training seminar. Attorneys don't have time. Right. And what we want is something that's usable right out of the box that makes sense. And, even right now, if you're a California litigator, you can hop onto Briefpoint, upload a document, and get a valuable product within 4 to 5 minutes of just logging in. And that is all possible because of Bridget's sort of relentless focus on ease and simplicity of use?
You know, there's obviously a lot of upside with AI tools, you know, for what you're doing there at Briefpoint. However, you know, there's a number of skeptics out there that worry about the potential downside of AI tools as well. So, and again, some of them may be more realistic than others, but there, you know, there's some of the things that you hear, like the arguments that, you know, the tools aren't trained on legal data, or the issue with AI simply making stuff up, or the idea that, and we touched on this briefly, that, it, you know, if you automate everything, then why would you need a lawyer? So I'm guessing that you've thought of, you know, most or all of these and more. So Nathan, let's start with you. What are your thoughts about when you hear people talk about the downside of AI tools?
Yeah, I mean, I think about this all the time. I think, you know, AI tools, AI generally, I think is something that is very concerning. And I don't think most people appreciate what the threat that AI poses to society. And I would encourage them to look up concepts like alignment and do research on that, because that is, frankly, in my opinion, the most important task for humanity to solve. And I don't know that we will be able to, but we need hope. Anyways, as far as the near future and the current issues. So yeah, the arguments are that there's inaccuracies, what we call hallucinations, at the risk of anthropomorphizing the AI systems. Mm-hmm. And hallucinations, I mean, Briefpoint's whole structure is designed to eliminate hallucinations. You can look at tools like Pablo's tool that also does the same. And the way we do that is you buy a tool that's built on top of the AI system. So you're not going to ChatGPT and asking for legal advice. That is probably not a good idea. Even though it did pass the bar in the 90th percentile, it's still not a good idea, especially if you're not familiar with that field of law.
Yeah.
And there's a risk of it sort of just pulling from its corpus of data and inputting it that isn't really applicable. But you can, what Pablo and what I are doing is we restrict the generated content to the immediate factual environment of the case. And by doing that, we eliminate the chance of hallucination, because we don't let it make assumptions. We don't let it guess. We give it all the rules and all the things, and we say, just here's the data, just do this task. And so by narrowing the scope of the AI's task, you increase its accuracy. Providing it with sufficient data to execute that task is obviously necessary. So that the hallucinations are sort of a thing that are not going to be an issue. They're an issue now because people are using ChatGPT, which is ill-advised. But when you hire a system that accesses these things, if they are a good system, then they will prevent that from happening. The next biggest threat is what we call over-reliance. And over-reliance happens when you just rubber stamp everything the AI generates. And that can be a problem, because even with, you know, reductions and hallucinations, you know, maybe the proposed argument isn't what's right for your client or case. You know, maybe that proposed argument elicits some procedural grounds for your opponent to do something that ultimately would have a net negative effect on your case. And so really understanding that you need to review the work as if it is a first year associate's work, and not over-relying on that. And that applies for everyone using AI systems. Over-reliance is always a threat. And yeah, I mean, there is certainly people that think that they'll replace attorneys. A brief point, we do not want to replace attorneys. We are always going to keep attorneys in the loop. We will never go direct to consumer unless we do so through a vendor who has processes to ensure compliance with unauthorized practice of law statutes. But that's far and away. We're not here to replace attorneys. We believe that we need attorneys in society. We need people with those critical thinking skills, because those are the people that are going to be able to address some of the appropriate regulations around artificial intelligence that may ultimately give us more time.
Yeah, and Bridget, what are some of the concerns that you've been addressing?
Yeah, I would say let's all just proceed with caution with AI. I think a lot of people could agree with that. And, you know, I've been reading and thinking about this a lot as well. I think that anyone who is, you know, a knowledge worker could be like slightly concerned about their future prospects. But I do think that AI can be, could be a great opportunity to automate the tasks in our lives that are mostly mundane and tedious and allow us to really connect with meaningful work, thoughtful work. And I think that's true for legal professionals. I would love that to be true. I think our product can help with that. And then I also think that there's an opportunity to have more legal professionals be experts in AI, because we're going to need that, because we need to have some guardrails placed around AI, and we need the people creating those to be experts to really know what's going on.
That's all right. I'm sure Senator Grassley and Schumer will come up with some excellent regulations that...
I don't know why I was afraid. But yeah, I forgot about that. You're right. No, I don't know. What was I thinking?
So we are at the point of the interview now where we ask our guests our crystal ball question. And so, Bridget, we'll start with you. Can you pull out your crystal ball and let us know what changes or challenges in the legal industry, or even in the UX design industry, do you see occurring over the next 2 to 5 years? And that, again, we've been telling people that may be too long right now. So just in the foreseeable future, let's do it there.
Sure. Yeah. I think the whole prospect of AI and what it can promise and what it will become in the next couple of years is probably a little bit unimaginable to us right now. So I'm really interested to see how designers and user experience practitioners are really going to bridge that gap into this like giant, huge new piece of technology that is overwhelming and maybe a little bit hard to understand, and how we're going to piece that out and like, you know, distill the value that that can provide in a more specific way and help facilitate that like human connection, so people are able to really connect to it, and AI will be able to ultimately like provide us value in our everyday lives.
The stuff that social media just sucks out of us, right? Nathan, how about you? What does your crystal ball say?
I think in the near term, I think there's going to be a lot more market pressure on the billable hour models. I think we're going to see a sort of a golden age for contingency fee based and flat fee billings, with flat fee billings in particular, you know, with relative to the billable hour, you know, your margins are not set. You can basically say it's going to be X dollars for this, you know, task or in these set of tasks. If we have to do these motions, it'll cost this. And then you can do those really quickly. And now the quicker you do it, the higher your margins. Whereas a billable hour, you're sort of like, okay, if I work these hours, this is how much I will make. And I think we're going to see a real sort of shift in the market where the law firms that are implementing these AI systems and then using more creative billing structures, or just the plaintiff's attorneys that are leveraging this technology, just be able to crank out cases at a higher quality and much faster. And with on the plaintiff side, because I'm enabling plaintiff's attorneys to take cases for much cheaper, given like the reduction in salary costs and overtime, et cetera, there's going to be an increase in litigation. So there's going to be a lot more cases brought, because now plaintiff's attorneys, who initially might be kind of wishy-washy on a case of this value given these facts, are now looking at doing another risk analysis where the actual cost to take that case is much less. So now they'll take cases that only have a 10% chance of success. And when every plaintiff's attorney is doing that, it's going to flood the courts with new cases. And then the defense firms are going to be overworked, and they're going to be basically, it's going to be hard for them to find staff, because if they're still doing the billable hour model, now their associates are overworked. Yeah. It's still the same structure. And the associates look at their friends at plaintiff's firms who are using these AI systems, who are taking months of vacation a year. And they're going to, the labor force is going to move in that direction, thereby exacerbating the problem. And I think it's inevitable that there's going to be a massive shift in the market for law. And I think it's a good shift. I think there's going to be some growing pains, which are going to be unfortunate. Yeah. And I'm not going to celebrate those. But I think ultimately there will be a net positive in the next few years.
Yeah. Well, and anyone that's worked in, especially in large law firms for any amount of time, understand that nothing gets a large law firm to change the way it acts than something exploding on them, just something blowing up. And I think, you know, sooner rather than later, this whole model, everyone's been saying it's unsustainable for, you know, 2-3 decades now, but I just don't see how you can't change, because you're eventually going to be forced to change.
Yeah, and that's especially true once these, you know, I work with small firms that are defense firms, and once they figure out how to reach the clients of the big firms and say, hey, I can provide you with the same, if not better, services for a tenth of the cost, and it's going to be much more transparent in structure. I mean, they say relationships are everything for clients, right? Well, relationships are valuable. And what I mean by that is that they can be valued, in that if you have you can be your best buds with some guy, but if you're just paying him hundreds of thousands of dollars and for the sake of you guys being friends, I don't think that's going to be a long-lasting relationship.
No, I know I don't have any friends like that, so it's Well, Nathan Walter and Bridget Albiro, thank you both for coming in and taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
And of course, thanks to all the listeners for taking the time to tune in to the Geek and Review podcast. If you enjoy the show, share it with a colleague. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on social media. Marlene can be found at GayBauerM on Twitter, and I can be reached at Glambert on Twitter. Nathan and Bridget, if someone wants to continue this conversation with you, what's the best place for them to find you? Bridget?
Oh, yeah. You can connect with me on LinkedIn.
Same goes for me. LinkedIn, Nathan Walter, Briefpoint CEO and legal engineer.
All right. And of course, listeners can also leave us a voicemail on our Geek and Review hotline at 713-487-7821. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry. Well, Nathan and Bridget, thanks again for coming in.
Cheers, Greg.
Thanks so much.